All right, should I get started? All righty. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Build. Welcome to my session. I'm Jay. Before I get started, just have an idea of who all I'm talking to here. How many of you are actively doing Kinect development, game titles or Kinect for Windows or what have you? Okay, maybe a third, two-thirds? No, let's say 40% of you. Is it Xbox? Raise your hand, Xbox developers. Okay, so you're all a few. So when you raise your hand, you're mostly talking about trying Kinect on Kinect for Windows, I assume, or on the Windows platform. Okay, cool. I'm going to talk to you guys a bit about things to think about when designing user interfaces for Kinect apps, a bit about how we think about Kinect and Kinect UI and designing for Kinect and where we think Kinect is going, and some things that we're doing to move it forward. So a bit about me. I've been working with Kinect for the past few years, first with developing Kinect UI for Xbox 360, and about almost the past 2 years now helping launch the Kinect for Windows program and building out the infrastructure for application developers to begin to take advantage of Kinect technology on the PC. So the Kinect for Windows team is a group that is bringing the core Kinect technology originally developed for Xbox 360 and opening up, making it a platform for Windows application developers so that all of you guys can begin to explore the capabilities of this new input type and the sensing technology that we've created and really get into the new frontier of human-computer interaction that we see. So I'm glad to see all of you here, and thanks for coming on this journey with us. This isn't strictly speaking my agenda, but this is kind of a list of topics that hopefully you walk away from today learning a bit about and understanding. So we're going to talk a bit about ranges or spheres of interaction and kind of get across the idea that inputs are good at some things and they're not so good at other things. And that includes Kinect. And so you'll learn a bit about what we think Kinect is great for in the broader sense and potentially what we think Kinect is not great for. And some of the problems that we're tackling first in developing Kinect for Windows interactions. We'll talk a bit about design methodology, both how you guys maybe should think about Kinect as an input for your application, and a bit about how we're approaching solving the problem above. And then I'll show you guys some technology demos to give you guys a demonstration of a prototype of things of what we've been up to. And also, before I go on, I should mention a couple other things. There's a talk tomorrow from Rob Relier, also from the Kinect for Windows team. My Kinect talk is a 200-level talk, so I guess that means like it's introductory or something. His is a 300-level talk, so it's going to be quite sophisticated. Basically, what I'll be doing is giving you guys an overview and kind of the philosophy of how to think about Kinect UI development. Rob will be going into actual programming for the Kinect for Windows SDK. And he will also be showing off some new technology demos in his talk as well. So check that out. We've also got a booth set up downstairs where you can interact with some of our current shipping SDK features, as well as a room just behind that where you can see some tech demos. Okay. So I'm going to do a bit of storytelling. I'm going to have a bit of conversation with you guys. This is going to kind of meander a bit, so just bear with me. But hopefully it all starts to make sense and tie together in the end. I'm going to deviate and tell you a bit of a story. I don't know, how many of you guys have seen the documentary about skateboarding in the 70s, Dogtown and Z-Boys? A few of you. Okay. So you guys will hopefully get the story I'm about to tell and the analogy. Skateboarding was one of the first board sports. At the time that the skateboard was invented, there wasn't really a concept that we have today of board sports, and there was just this idea of doing things on boards. Today we've got wakeboarding, wake surfing, surfing, skateboarding, snowboarding, kiteboarding. The idea of interacting with a board and riding on any kind of surface is quite common, quite natural, in fact. Most children growing up learn some kind of board sport, and it's quite commonplace today. But when skateboarding came about, it was a new device. And the only board sport that existed was surfing, and so people didn't talk about board sports, they just talked about surfing as a very specific thing. And so some of the first adopters of skateboards were, in fact, surfers. And they saw the skateboard as a way to practice their moves, stay in shape, hone technique in the off season, or when conditions weren't great for going out onto the water and riding a surfboard. So some of the very first movements that were practiced on a skateboard were, in fact, surfing motions and surfing moves. And here you see an example of a rider in the early 70s on a skateboard doing a very surf-derived motion. And he's riding current state-of-the-art circa 1970 with rubber wheels, steel trucks, and a unidirectional or directional skateboard. And there weren't dedicated places to go skateboarding, so people used hills that would allow them to build momentum, and they would simply travel down the hill and carve back and forth to ride the skateboard. They were limited by the technology. They were limited by their understanding of what a skateboard was for and how you should interact with it and how you should ride on it. They were influenced by their preconceived idea of what a board was for coming from surfing. But there were a group of dedicated enthusiasts who were very passionate about and enjoyed riding the skateboard, and so they pushed the sport and saw what they could do. And they sought out new environments for riding a skateboard, and they attempted to kind of push the limits of the technology and what their bodies could do. And some of them discovered that in looking for the best place to emulate the feel of riding up and down the waves on a surfboard was an empty swimming pool, a curved surface that they could carve up and down, just like carving up and down the face of a wave. And what these folks would do is do bottom turns and cut back at the top of the lip of the pool. And they began advancing the sport by seeking out that new environment. The sport also began to progress because the technology of the board itself improved. Here you see a skateboarding. Now he's riding a non-directional board. It's symmetrical. He's also now got urethane wheels, which are stronger, provide better grip on cement. He's got a wider board with grip tape, providing a more stable platform. And he's got a little bit of safety gear, because recognizing that it's a dangerous sport he's participating in, he's now got a helmet. But because he's pushing the limits, he picked up a few broken bones along the way. So these athletes that were seeking out the perfect way to emulate a surf wave in these swimming pools began again pushing the limits and progressing what could be done on a skateboard. And one brave fellow was actually able to do something that had never been done on a surfboard, and it was the first time it was done on a skateboard, because he's actually able to leave contact with the concrete and get above the lip of the pool. And the very first time that was done, that was quite a groundbreaking, radical thing. It's like skateboarding is now no longer strictly purely emulating surfing on a wave. You don't, at the time at least, you did not leave the surface of the water with your surfboard. But now it's being done on a skateboard. Skateboarding is now different. It is now unique. And it had now progressed into becoming its own sport and its own with its own identity. And that takes us to where the sport has gotten to progress to today, where it's literally its own category with its own dedicated enthusiasts who start on a skateboard. They don't come from surfing. In fact, most kids who pick up a skateboard have never ridden a surfboard. It's got its own set of heroes. Here now we have Shaun White, who is famous both as an Olympic gold medalist in snowboarding, as well as a world champion skateboarder. Making money sponsored by companies like Monster in this case, and there's dedicated environments for practicing this sport. Here is an actual stadium with an audience, with something that was never previously imagined, in, you know, 30, 40 years ago when the sport was first coming into its own. And now things that look completely ludicrous look absolutely natural and normal because of the way we've progressed the sport and how we think about it. So the idea of leaving the ground with a skateboard, and in fact, having your body leave contact with a skateboard seems quite normal. So what I'm kind of getting to with this point is a bit of an analogy for how we think about Connect. And so Connect UI in the early stages of evolution and progression. And we are still learning, you know, how to augment existing interfaces with Kinect input. And so a lot of our thinking about Kinect UI comes from how we've traditionally been thinking about UI for other inputs. And so just like in the early days of skateboarding, we're very much influenced by how we think about computers, what computer technology is actually capable of and what it's developed for, and the ways that we program and the ways we think about interacting with computers. Some of the ways that we're going to progress and evolve with Kinect will come through providing standard ways of interacting with the device. Just like kids now who just start learning skateboarding are taught standard moves, like they learn to ollie, they learn to do kick flips, and these are standardized skateboarding moves that are just kind of expected to be learned as part of progressing through the sport. Some of this will come through standardization. And we will familiarize people with how they should perceive Kinect and how they should think about interacting with Kinect when they know it's available for them as an input. And so consumers will learn, as they've learned with other inputs, what the system expects them to do. And that's going to be part of it. But the other part that's going to happen is the technology itself will be evolving and improving over time. And obviously, Microsoft's making a huge investment in R&D in this space on the hardware capabilities, as well as the computer understanding, the software that really gives intelligence to the Kinect device. And so through these advancements in the technical capabilities, we'll more closely be able to observe the environment that Kinect is placed in, and specifically identify human actions and human intent to more naturally respond and shape the computing experience to how people naturally want to interact with it. So now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and just kind of go through a proof point to reinforce an idea, which is that input impacts the design of interfaces. And so what do I mean by that? Well, here's an example. Here's a piece of hardware that Microsoft makes that is an input, and it's the keyboard, and it's been around for many, many years. You press a button, and it indicates a specific character. And so what sort of UI is derived when you have this as your input? Well, it's a character-based input, in this case, a command line interface. And that's perfectly good for many computing tasks, for writing software, in fact. But it's for consumers a perfectly acceptable way to draft email, to draft documents, and to be productive. There's nothing wrong with this particular input or this particular interface. There's something that it's great for, which is those tasks, but potentially not other sorts of tasks that people may want to do with a computer. So that's one example. But I will illustrate again, just to really drive my point home. The mouse, again, a piece of hardware that Microsoft makes. This is a plug for Microsoft hardware. I'm not here to promote Kinect as the end-all be-all of inputs. In fact, we're very proud of all the hardware we make as inputs. It's quite good. This particular mouse has a couple of buttons, a scroll wheel, but primarily the mouse, what it's known for is tracking X and Y in a plane. So if the input can track X and Y in a plane, again, what is the corresponding UI that you derive from that input? And we see, voila, the culmination of many years using a mouse is the GUI, the traditional two-dimensional desktop that people become familiar with for the past 30-some-odd years now. Okay, so again, now one more example. What about touch? And how does touch impact UI design? Well, in a very, very strong way, of course. Because what you see with Windows 8 and other touch-based operating systems is that now the UI has evolved because of the way the input is handled and because of the way the input works. Even though displays have gotten thinner, smaller, higher resolution, gone from monochromatic to color, SD to HD to 3D, even though there's been a movement from displays that are fixed to portable, from moderate and desktop size to large and small, and there's this broad spectrum of output capability on the display side, the input is still fundamentally driving the way that the UI is designed. And you see that today with our portable devices and our touch-based user interfaces, where they're all designed to support touch selection with a finger, with large buttons, and to recognize swipe gestures and multi-touch input and use those as their primary method of interaction. And so you can see in each of these examples how it's relatively straightforward now in hindsight to see what the ultimate interface should look like given a particular input technology. So what if this is your input? What if something that can see that there is a person in an environment, observe their motion, potentially hear their voice, what sort of user interface is derived from that category of input? And we're still learning. And this is kind of the journey we're on and the progression that we're going through. So in a very, very broad sense, here's kind of our philosophy for where we see this going and what we see it looking like. We see interactions that are effortless, transparent, and contextual. So ultimately, you know, we want to design interfaces with Connect that require as little effort on the user to understand and are completely transparent to them ultimately and aware of the user's context and what they want to do and what they should be doing, what they are expected to be doing in that particular space. We see the communication being fluid between users and the technology and being one-to-one, one person to one system, one to many. A user who's able to interact with many systems, and then many to many where multiple people are able to interact with each other through multiple devices. And what that can mean potentially is seamless transition between vision, voice, gesture, or touch, or other input types. And that this becomes more and more natural over time because given a particular context and a particular input, it's just natural to move from a mouse to a keyboard to touch, and then potentially to being away from a computer, interacting at a distance, using gesture and voice. So here's an example of a Connect user interface, an application of Connect that's quite natural as an answer to that question. What is the obvious Connect UI? So here, you know, with Connect Sports and Connect Gaming in general, the most successful initial application has been having direct control over a 3D environment where an avatar is placed in 3D space. And the user you know, is able to mimic sporting actions naturally that they are quite familiar with, in this case volleyball, but also running in place or jumping, motions that they understand and then see them translated on screen through a character, through an avatar in a 3D environment for gameplay. And that's made quite a bit of sense and been quite successful for us as an initial application of Connect. So what are some other Connect UI applications that we've observed? So we're starting to see developers with Connect for Windows explore the interface possibilities. And here's one example. This was developed actually by a marketing agency in a promotion of a sports energy drink as part of a viral marketing campaign down in Australia. And what they did was they developed software that allowed a person to use their body to create a song, not as an instrument, but as a DJ. And what this UI that they developed did allowed them to select different instruments or samples. And by moving forward and touching the ground, they could select different tones based on arm placement up and down and around them. And they could control pitch and things like that through distance between their hands and distance between the ground. And this was a really, really interesting project that actually resulted in a really interesting, successful output. The song that was made in real time at the live event where they ran this outdoors actually for a while was number one on iTunes. And they were really successful with marketing as a result. And kind of what this gets to is back to my point about the progression of sports and whatnot, is that those who are out there exploring Connect and pushing the boundaries right now are really making a name for themselves. And the small community of Connect developers, which includes a handful of you guys here, are pushing computing forward. And just, you know, like Jobs and Gates are kind of synonymous with the desktop computing revolution and defining what desktop computing became. The work that you guys are going to be doing in this space as you build Connect for Windows apps, you know, will actually create a legacy. And you know, you might be in a black and white photo someday, just like that skateboarder from the 70s. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and just talk about some of the things to consider when coming up with your application and thinking about how you want to use Connect. So Connect UI needs to consider a range of modes of interaction. You need to think about, where is your user expected to be, and will they be transitioning through different distances in this case? Will they be seated? Will they be far away? Will they be standing and close? And will they be looking or not looking at the system? And you may have to account for a user who will expect to most naturally interact with touch when they're close, and don't ignore the most obvious input. There's no reason to force gesture on a user who's seated 2 feet from the computer to select something when they can just reach out and touch the screen or touch a mouse or touch a keyboard. That's not to say, though, that gesture can't augment input. So gesture, along with tactile inputs and voice, and a UI that's designed for 2 feet can work in harmony. Similarly, if users far away, now they're not in contact with the system, potentially the inputs available to them may become gesture and voice, but may also become a companion device, a slate or a mobile phone. And so it's okay to think about multiple inputs working in tandem, working in harmony, and not having to strictly force all tasks, all modes of interaction for your application through one input type. An example of that might be, you know, on Xbox 360 today, a user can be in front of their couch, or in front of their TV with a Kinect on their couch, and using voice to search for content and to launch content with gesture. But when they get into the experience, they can pull out their gamepad or pull out their phone and use smart glass and begin interacting with a game or with a piece of movie content in a way that's very natural and seamless. And that's okay, because if the user understands what input is best for and what's expected of them, they will use the input that's most natural for them. So another thing to think about is that's a really tough challenge is Connect UI needs to determine the user's intent if there's not an explicit UI. So when a user's in an environment and Connect is available along with other inputs, the system needs to know when the user actually intends to be interacting through Connect and when it's not. If the system is always on and always looking, you can't have a Connect UI always responding to every motion and every sound in the room. That could interfere with other inputs. It could become annoying if the user doesn't actually intend to interact with the computer and doesn't want to be disturbed. And it can be annoying if you start driving inadvertent input into the UI when the user has an intention. So engagement is a really important initial part of the experience to consider. So some things to think about are, you know, the user intends to engage here. They're using voice. They're not in view, but they're speaking. And so you want to have affordances built into the UI that understand the user's intending to address the system. Similarly, you know, the case where the user's addressing the system, facing forward, looking into it, what are the ways that the user wants to express engagement, and do you recognize those? As opposed to here, where you have two users, one of them which is choosing to be engaged and one of them which is not. Okay, so what do we want to do with Connect for Windows, given the current state of technology, the current state of computing, and some of these issues that I've called out with spheres of interaction and understanding users' engagement or users' intent. So one of the things we want to do is begin to provide that common interaction model so that developers can easily build their Connect apps and so that consumers can start to understand how they're expected to interact with a system that has Connect. And we initially want to solve the most common application experiences, and that includes identifying engagement, helping a user to target something and select something on a screen, and to navigate in X and Y. And you might ask, well, why do you want to go back now to thinking about these sort of two-dimensional touch or mouse sort of paradigms with targeting and selecting content and moving in X and Y? Well, the reason is that while we really see the value of Connect being in that immersive, interactive, natural engagement like sports or like that fun DJing application, that's where the real value of the Connect interaction ultimately lies. The user still does want to be able to express when they want to start that experience and when they want to stop that experience, and needs a way to initialize it and to end it. And so we want to give people a way through Connect without having to walk up to a system or pull out a companion device to initiate and terminate and target and select and to drive a computing experience, because of the fact that we are talking about building apps on top of the computing environments of today and the operating systems of today, which are geared towards those other inputs. So the other thing that we're doing through the Connect for Windows program in conjunction with our work on Connect for Xbox 360 is we're trying to ensure that Connect for Windows interactions and these controls are intuitive and delightful for end users. So we're currently investing a lot of R&D in discovering how are users expressing their intent to interact with a UI at a distance, and what do they tend to do naturally? And then when we present a UI to them, how are they successful in achieving their goals? And can we tune a system to be able to respond to a broad swath of the human race? And so we're currently actively testing a multitude of interactions with a very kind of scientific, rigorous approach, observing what people are successful with. If they're presented with a specific interaction type, what are the range of ways in which people move to interact with that control, and can we support the spectrum from small to tall, from young to old, and all the ways that people might perceive they're supposed to interact? Can we support them in the most broad and intuitive way? And lastly, of course, you know, our mission is to advance the capabilities of Connect and begin to show progression of the technology and start to bring more of that to you guys as application developers to take advantage of to help push this new realm of human-computer interaction forward. So what I'm going to do now is show you guys some demos of some prototypes of some controls that we're building. This is early prototype, so bear with me if things go wrong. I may have to restart something. This PC came from my desktop this morning. I'm going to show you a couple of those things, which are engagement, targeting and selection, and navigating in X and Y. So I will switch over here. Hopefully those in the back can see me. Oops, I got to unlock this guy. Locked. But I'll be interacting in front of the big screen over there. So bear with me. Okay, so currently the system is not observing anyone engaged. And what you'll see is a window at the top of the screen which is displaying the output of what Connect is seeing. It sees a row of seats, there's somebody sitting there, but they are not engaged with the system, and there's nobody interacting at this time. And there is no cursor on the screen, the buttons aren't doing anything. So if I walk into the field of view of the Connect, oops, I may have to restart this guy. It went to sleep. Like I said, it's prototype code. It came out front of my desk this morning. All Okay, there we go. That makes more sense. So I stand and address the connect. I'm illuminated in blue. I'm identified as a tracked person, but I'm still not able to actually directly interact in any way. I'm just simply recognized as capable of interacting with the system. On Xbox 360 today, a similar system view is shown, and what a user is asked to do in that system is to wave to engage, and there's a gesture that we recognize when the user raises their arm and waves back and forth enough times, will then wake up a cursor after waving. And what we learned was that wasn't necessarily the most natural way or the way that people expected to interact with Kinect. They had to learn that behavior and be instructed on that behavior and learn the exact wave gesture. And so what we're looking at now is we're observing how people want to naturally reach out and address the Kinect, and what they're doing is just raising their hand and feeling around it. And as soon as they do that now, we'll recognize, hey, this user is here, and he's actually intending to address the system. And so now the cursor will wake up. And if I drop my hand, I'm no longer intending to address the system. I'm no longer engaged with it. The cursor goes away, and so now I'm not inadvertently driving the UI. But as soon as I raise my hand up again, we'll recognize that, and we will begin to drive the experience. So the next thing we're doing is working on improving targeting and selection in X and Y. And what we've got is a much more ergonomically refined interaction zone over what was initially developed in Xbox 360. We observed the range of motion that people found natural. And we design a physical interaction zone, which is the region out in front of the user where they place their hand that allows them to come in contact with the different portions of the screen. And so we found that people don't like reaching far across their bodies. They don't like reaching far away from their bodies. And we've designed this physical interaction zone that provides X and Y targeting to be as ergonomic as possible. And as natural as possible for the user. So now what happens when I actually want to select something? What we found is that when we asked users, hey, how would you select an item on screen? What they naturally want to do is just kind of reach out and actually kind of touch it, even though there wasn't anything there to touch. So we're now experimenting with that idea as a way for a user just naturally target and then select something. On the Xbox 360 and in the Kinect for Windows SDK version 1.6, we've demonstrated that by dwelling on an item for long enough, you can ultimately select it. And there's a cursor that has a timer with a ring that fills, and the user's informed, don't stay here too long, otherwise you will end up selecting this item. And one of the behaviors that we observed when we implemented that paradigm was that users became scared of targeting anything because they felt like a bomb was going to go off. Oh my God, the timer's going to go off. I got to move. I got to keep moving. I better keep moving. Otherwise, something will get selected. I don't know what I want to select yet, but I got to keep moving. And they had a fear of inadvertently targeting something because of the pressure of the timer. So if we take that away and instead just let them reach toward what they want, now we're naturally responding the way that people kind of expect to interact with the system. And the really interesting thing about this this press gesture that we've developed is we haven't trained it as a specific motion that needs to be recognized by the system. So the user doesn't need to learn how to press. They simply need to reach towards the thing that they want to target. And there's a couple of things going on here. We're providing strong visual cues for the user so that they can see right away that if I move my arm in Z, the system's observing that and something's happening. So pressing means something to this system. And then the next thing we're doing is we're providing a mechanism by which they can observe I'm about to press. So this button is compressing. And if they don't want to select it, they can choose to back off, or they can continue that action until it's ultimately selected. And then the other thing was is that everybody presses slightly differently. So some people naturally want to keep their arm out quite straight. And so if I do that, I can still tap the button by flicking my wrist. But if I'm somebody who wants to keep my arm more relaxed or is maybe more familiar with the system and doesn't want to be fatigued for a long time, you know, I can press with my arm and my elbow. And we support recognizing all of those, because that gets back to the philosophy of trying to get as natural an understanding how people want to interact with a system as possible. And so then I'll show you another demo, which is going to show off movement in X and Y, kind of completing the picture of traditional content navigation that an application might have to expose to a user in order to get them into an experience. So in this prototype, what we've added to that engagement and targeting and selecting interaction is a grip recognizer and scrolling interaction. So now when I raise my hand to engage, do I focus? Yeah, focus. Oh, no. there we go. Okay, now when I raise my hand to engage, I can also open and close my hand. And now with a closed fist, I can manipulate the canvas to move through a large list of content. And in this particular example, we've emulated some touch-like implementations of scrolling in that there's a notion of sort of swiping across a surface. And I can directly manipulate, sort of like scrubbing on a touch screen, or I can apply some sort of velocity to move quickly through the page. And then when I get to the piece of content I want, you know, I can press it. So these are the sorts of interactions that we're currently putting through a lot of usability testing, doing a lot of research and machine learning to support for as broad a population as possible. And ultimately, what we want to do is provide these to you guys in the development community so that your value add with Connect, your experience with Connect, your version of Connect Sports or your DJ application can have a seamless end-to-end experience for your customers. And through the combination of standardization, improvements in technology, and then, you know, great hero experiences that you guys develop, you know, we will have great Connect applications out there and really wow our customers and wow people in the future who look back and realize that we were the pioneers who kind of changed computers forever. So that wraps up my demo and my talk, but I'm happy to field questions if you've got any questions about the demo or just about what we're doing with Connect and Connect for Windows. You know, I can't announce an exact date right now other than to say we're in active development of common controls that we want to make available in Connect for Windows. And, you know, you'll be hearing announcements soon. Yeah, I can't announce at this time anything more specific than that, unfortunately. But you can see, given the state of where we're at and kind of the direction we're going, that we're reasonably far along with something, and we want to get this to you as soon as it's ready. Yes. Oh, yeah. Mics so that folks watching the video and elsewhere in the room can hear you. Go ahead and come on up.
I'm curious, are you guys doing anything with MFA? Doing any like facial recognition or anything. And when we looked at the SDK, it was all gesture-based, but like on the Xbox, it'll do light, you know, sort of identity type of thing. So I'm interested if there's anything like that on the Windows side.
Yes. So one of the things that's available in the SDK right now is the facial feature tracking component that was initially developed in Microsoft Research and then shipped as part of the Avatar Connect experience. So if you've ever used Avatar Connect, it's a simple little application that allows you to teleconference virtually with somebody through an avatar, and it will track your facial features. And what we've done is expose the facial feature tracking in the Connect for Windows SDK. And we're finding that's a really interesting way for folks to identify user engagement, especially when seated. And so back to the point I was making about, you know, how do you understand users' intent to engage, and how do you design something that works at a range of distances? Obviously, face tracking becomes much more interesting in a near mode range of interaction, where raising my hands might not be natural, but simply turning in my chair to the computer and looking at the screen could be quite natural. And so while I don't have a demonstration of that particular interaction here today, and that is something that folks who want to build an app could begin to evolve and prototype and develop themselves using that tech. Identity, is, in terms of facial feature recognition, is not yet a part of the SDK. In the broader sense, yes, it's on our roadmap, because the Connect for Windows organization, one of our charters or goals is to bring all of the capabilities of Connect as seen on Xbox and open those up to the community. So our goal is over time to make as much of the Connect platform available for development as possible. Yeah, go on, come on up to the mic. Oh, in modern, is your question. Yeah, so we don't have anything to announce at this time as in terms of a modern API or making these controls available in the modern shell. But you know, stay tuned, and we are obviously always pushing forward and progressing, as I said.
I was curious what kind of business applications you're seeing being early adopters with this.
Yeah, great question. So we've got a ton of enterprise interest from a really broad swath of the commercial space. And that spans retail, healthcare, defense, business, education. It's really all over the map. And some the most promising initial applications seem to be in larger displays and public spaces, retail, and those sorts of applications where you may have a one-to-many sort of system that you want to give a message out to many people and then allow a one-to-one communication when a person wants to specifically interact with the system. Connect's a great way to reach an audience and to allow them to interact with a product and to engage them in an immersive way that they haven't been able to before. So we're seeing a lot of interest from the retail community, marketing community, and specifically for use in public spaces and with larger displays. There's obviously other applications of interest. People are looking at telecommunications and teleconferencing as an interesting application. But as you saw with that DJ application, that was a way for a marketing company to reach an audience through performance and interacting with a computer that reached millions of people ultimately through that one-to-many sort of interaction. So it's basically wide open right now. There's a ton of exploration. I think we've got 90% of Microsoft's top enterprise customers all actively looking at Connect application and Connect opportunities. I think something like 100 of the S&P 500 looking at incubating ideas with Connect. So there's a very broad range of interest.
Have you guys been looking also at, what you presented was nice, but it was like the surfboard example and the skateboard. That was still old UI. There was
nothing
like groundbreaking where it was like, wow. Like, for example, like, are you looking at augmented reality where you probably would pair multiple connects to a notion of space and interaction of space or other things like that?
Yeah, and I freely admit that the controls that I demonstrated were looking at adding Connect to an existing paradigm. And what we see as the real value add is the application experience that we allow you guys to develop. And so there are absolutely folks who are playing with augmented reality, and that's an example in that retailing case or merchandising case where an application developer can green screen somebody into a virtual environment or similarly can composite a virtual item into video feed of the actual environment and allow people to interact with it. And those are exactly precisely the applications of Connect we see as most natural, as most compelling, as most suitable for the device. And so we're actually not dictating how people should be doing that, because that's really where the value add is of the application. And so we want you guys to be able to explore what's going to be most suitable for your environment and for your particular market. And simply what we're looking at providing is acknowledgement that for somebody to get into that experience and out of that experience, they may have to choose from a menu to start up. They may have to select something from a range of options, and they may have to end the experience. And so we want to provide an easy way for you guys to have those affordances and then focus on the value add, which may be an augmented reality experience or some other really creative UI like that DJ UI you saw, which was fantastic and highly differentiated, but very brand specific and scenario specific. And we want you guys to be spending your time on being creative in that space and not have to worry about how do I just bring up a cursor and how do I let somebody select from a list of N choices. Because one of the things that our early adopters expressed frustration on is, hey, I'm doing something with green screening a user into an environment, and that's what I want to be working on in the application I want, but I'm spending as much time on just getting a cursor up and giving a way for a user to press a button as I am on the core application experience. And so we want to solve that problem for our community. Could you guys maybe just queue up behind the fellow at the mic, and then that way everybody can get their question. And the folks who are watching online can also hear the question. So go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I was really excited of seeing the new hand gestures, and especially the open-close hand
thing
that you show. What I'm basically asking is this some kind of high-level stuff that we get, or can I just have an event when the user closes a door or opens their hand and maybe have this as a click event on a button?
Yeah, so how we're thinking about developing these interactions and the tech is that we want the platform to be as flexible as possible, and we want to make as much of the building blocks for the tech available to the development community as possible. So we're definitely thinking about lower level ways of exposing low level gesture recognition and events to the application, as well as higher level application and UI framework concepts to apps, so that the developer that just wants to drag and drop a button into their UI can do that. And then the developer who wants to get more sophisticated and build a very custom application experience can do that as well with some of the predefined gestures that we recognize.
So can I mix and match? Can I, for example, do something crazy like use your button, but have, I don't know, only click it when I do three blinks with my hand? So this kind of crazy stuff.
Yeah, since we haven't yet released these components in an SDK, we haven't actually standardized or defined the API for you guys yet, so that's not set. But we're definitely open to that idea. One thing that we're trying to balance is back to that point I was trying to make around setting people's expectations and getting them used to a standard way of interacting with Connect. We don't want experiences to be so different fundamentally that people don't know what they're supposed to do when they see Connect and how they're supposed to interact with it. But we do want people to be able to be creative and to build highly differentiated branded experiences at the same time. So we're playing with that tension. So an example might be we want to keep the physical interaction zone that people kind of understand. Here is the range within which Connect is observing and seeing and tracking my hands if I'm doing a hand tracking based mode of interaction. And they know that if they're kind of in this space that Connect should work, and that they don't have to reach further out in order to drive a menu. We may want to standardize that. But the range of gestures you do within that could be varied with the imagination. And so we're still playing with the balance of how much of the low-level gestures do we expose, and what ways do we put them together so that we maintain some level of consistency but some level of flexibility. We're still playing with those trade-offs. Okay. But yes, in general, we want those building blocks to be exposed, and we want you guys to be flexible in how you put together your UI.
Excellent. Great job. Thank you.
How well does Connect work outside, like in outdoors and broad sunlight?
Yeah, so because the depth image of Connect comes from an IR pseudo-random pattern that requires the sensor to be able to see the IR that it projects. And so if there's a source of IR in the environment that's stronger than the pattern output, the pattern won't be observable. And so something that does put out a very strong source of IR is the sun. And it will effectively over-illuminate an item that Kinect is also shining a pattern onto and make it invisible to Kinect. So something to think about if you're looking at an outdoor experience is, can you shade the object you want to observe? The Kinect itself being in sunlight isn't the issue. The thing to think about is the thing that I want to observe should be reasonably shaded from IR if you want to see it in sunlight. Similarly to video, and Kinect also has a video feed, you have to realize if you want to use video that you need a source of light, a source of white light, in order to illuminate your object to be able to see it in the video camera. It's very similar, except in the inverse with the depth image. So generally, we recommend Kinect for use indoors, but we have seen some pretty creative uses of Kinect outdoors. In fact, that DJ application was actually performed outdoors, although they chose to do it at night for a good reason, both because they projected onto a very large screen. A projector output tends to work well in a dark room, but Kinect also works best in the dark. Were there any other questions or one more? I guess I could just say very broadly that Microsoft's investing heavily in sensor technology and advancing the capabilities both of the hardware and the software. And we're looking at ways to advance the capabilities of Kinect to bring it to new environments, as well as for the ones that we already see it being used in, to expand its range of capabilities to allow new forms of interaction and to improve on the current ones. Sorry, I can't say much more than that. Yeah?
If there are multiple actors in front of Kinect, how does Kinect know which is the primary actor?
Great question. So I'm not even sure if Rob's going to get into this one or not, but he may be able to show a demonstration of it in his talk tomorrow. Otherwise, there's some examples in the Kinect for Windows SDK for that today. So the human skeletal tracking capability that we provide in the SDK can track up to six potential people in a scene and label them. And we can track up to two of them in real time, all of their skeletal joints that Kinect recognizes. So the application basically sees six potential targets, can choose two of them, and track their movements in real time. All right, well, thanks a lot for coming to my talk. Be sure to check out the demo downstairs, as well as check out Rob's programming talk tomorrow.